Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a song of life, loneliness, solitude, and the sublime.
Sounds drift in. The buildings are remembered. The life of the city never lets go, nor do you ever want it to.
It's also a song of the contradiction that is the poet Wallace Stevens.
Unwilling that mercy should be a mystery of silence, that any solitude of sense should give you more than their peculiar chords and reverberations clinging to whisper still.
That is Stevens reading his 1952 poem to an old philosopher in Rome. On the outside, Wallace Stevens was the picture of success, a Harvard graduate, a successful legal career and marriage. But on the inside, turbulence. And it was that turbulence that gave rise to Stevens' seeking verse, The Emperor of Ice Cream, The Snowman, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, all meditations on the beauty and the terror found in the world.
There is something so deeply attractive, so haunting about what he is saying.
This is Paul Mariani, poet and professor at Boston College. Mariani has written biographies of five other major poets, including William Carlos Williams, Hart Crane, and Robert Lowell. But it is Stevens he has loved most deeply for more than 50 years. And that love courses through every page of Mariani's latest biography. It's called The Whole Harmonium, The Life of Wallace Stevens. We recently spoke with Paul Mariani and began by asking him why Wallace Stevens is so important to him.
You read a simple sentence by Stevens, she sang beyond the genius of the sea, and you realize, wow, wait a minute, what is this about, the genius of the sea? What is this genius of the sea? And then you go back to the Latin and you realize it's the genius loci, or the sense of the spirit of a place. Okay, so I can understand that. But also, you know, from Emerson on, all the transcendentalists in the United States in the 19th, early 20th century, what do we make of this? How does nature speak to us? How do we speak to nature? How do we correspond to nature? And in a sense, what Stevens is saying in the very opening line is that somehow we sing, we poets, because we have language, can sing beyond what nature itself can sing. So that's one thing that keeps bringing me back to Stevens.
Well, so the line that you quoted there, she sang beyond the genius of the sea, is of course from Wallace Stevens' poem, The Idea of Order at Key West. And we actually have a little recording here of Stevens himself reading the first stanza of the poem. So let's listen to that together.
She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice, like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. And yet, its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry that was not ours, although we understood, inhuman, of the veritable ocean.
Hmm. Now, Paul, when you hear Stevens himself reading that, what is it that you're hearing?
Oh, my gosh. I hear a number of things. On the one hand, you hear the gentleman, the executive from Hartford, in a three-piece suit, standing apart, with armor on his breast there so that you can't penetrate. On the other hand, you hear a very deep human cry calling out for connection. It's that contrast, if you will, the two sides of the human condition, the way we say, how are you? And we say, oh, I'm fine, thank you, but unless we find somebody in whom we can say, to whom we can say, how are you? And we can really say, this is how I am. And this is what Stevens offers, both the edifice as well as a human being, the ghost still crying out 60 years after his death.
Well, at what point in his career did he write this poem? Because in your book, you write that that this poem in particular was an announcement that he had once again found his voice.
Yes. Yes. You know, we have the poems that so many people, you know, if you ask them, you know, what poems do you know? The Emperor of Ice Cream, the Snowman. These are all from Harmonium. This is the first volume. And that was published only when he was 44 years old, his first volume. But what happened was he had seen that he had talked himself into a position in which he did not know where to go. And for 10 years he was silent. Finally, in the early 1930s, he begins to write again. And this is the announcement, the idea of order at Key West. What is it that the poet can add to our sense of reality? How does the poet not only speak to us philosophically, but how does the poet touch our very hearts? And, you know, looking at him in the pictures, you'd say, what his boss said when he died. He said, if you had told me he had that he died of a heart attack, I didn't know he had a heart, you know. Well, he did. So that's, I think, what the announcement is.
Well, you know, Paul, this is so interesting because already we've touched upon this several times about the profound contrast between Stevens, the exterior person, and the interior soul, right, that he had. I love the way you said it a little earlier, that even as you heard him read, there is still that tone of the man in the suit, the executive in the suit. And I just wonder if we could talk specifically about sort of that part of his life, because you know, he was born in 1879 in Pennsylvania. As a young man, does go to Harvard, tries his hand at poetry and journalism, but then I think this might come as a surprise to a lot of people who don't know his life in particular. He ends up working for in the insurance industry, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. His father was a lawyer. And so his father said, look, why don't you go into law? Forget this, you know, trying to write poetry. I mean, that's okay. It's an avocation. If you, and you've tried to be a cub reporter down in New York for the New York Herald. That hasn't worked out. So, look, why don't you go to school? Why don't you go to law school? And he did. He said, look, I'm never, never going to beg. I'm never going to be one of those artists, say, down in Greenwich Village, for example, okay, which he knew. He knew the whole group who were asking for donations in this. I am going to make it on my own. I'm going to make it as an American executive. And the poetry then, when I've got the time, that will be my secret world.
Mm. So I'm just curious, as a writer, for a subject like Stevens, whose external life seems rather quotidian, if I could say.
Yes.
How is it that Stevens himself first fell in love with poetry as a young man or found it as a medium, an artistic means by which, of expressing that the profundity of that we've discussed he had internally that maybe he didn't express externally?
What happened was he would write poetry. And it was the poetry of the time, okay, because he's trying to learn. And, of course, he doesn't have his own voice yet. So he's imitating the poets at the turn of the century that are being anthologized. The real breakthrough comes in New York City. And it comes as a result of this extraordinary explosion of energy. It's amazing how much the painters... the modern painters, Picasso and Juan Gris and Braque and Duchamp and others, are influencing, because they're looking at what the old paintings were, but then he's looking at this new painting which explodes on the page, and he says, it's time to change. It's time to make poetry new. And of course, you've got a number of poets, Marianne Moore, and you've got William Carlos Williams and others. And all of this energy is coming up. And he picks it up and he begins to say, this is the direction in which I'm going to go. In The Emperor of Ice Cream, say, or The Snowman, or other poems like that, critics called him a dandy. They got it partly right. He is a dandy in the sense in which the language that he's using, you know, a line, oh, well, here's a line from The Emperor of Ice Cream. Call the roller of big cigars, the muscular one, and bid him whip in kitchen cups, concupis, and curds. How many of us would say that for making ice cream? You know? And of course, there's just this deliciousness of the words. You just, even if you don't know what they mean, there's something about that the kitchen cups, concupis, and curds, you know, that you can recite it, repeat it 100 times. Just the delight of language. The difference between saying having to read all kinds of insurance reports, okay, and the language that, you know, that we get from 9 to 5.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that language, and then, okay, I'm going to take you into another whole new space.
Right.
Just come with me. Yeah.
Right. But I do have to say, and this is something that you also write about in the book, there are other aspects of Stevens. Stevens the misanthrope, Stevens the patriarch. I mean, he was writing in a time period where perhaps looking at him through the eyes of, you know, two people, you and I in 2016, that are a little less or a little more unsavory. Am I dancing around the truth here?
A little more savory. Yes. No.
Was that a terrible way of putting it?
No, you're absolutely right, Magna. This generation is my grandfather's generation, and in many ways my own father's generation. This is, in fact, what they the way they thought. Some of the anti-racist, even once in a while, an anti-Semitic remark. You know, nobody on the streets of New York escapes, for example, when he's a young man. But you know, but then you hope you grow up, you draw it out of yourself. You know, the connection with other human beings, all human beings. There's something there that they can teach us. Stevens, however, did not. He was not an incredibly social person. So you would find Stevens going up into his room, alone, and opening the window, and watching the moonlight, watching the stars, listening to opera. But most of this was all by himself. His wife would be in her, after dinner in her room. He would be in his room, and his daughter would be in somewhere in the middle there studying. Mm-hmm. And that was their life.
On that note, there's something that you write in the book, which I just wanted to read back to you, because, you know, trying to grapple with this question of, you know, is there a theme or what could be the themes to Stevens' life and his work? You write that there was about the earth a terrifying and awesome sublimity capable of crushing us in an instant. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. You know, there is a sense in which you can look at the world and it can simply overwhelm you. It's that sense of the sublime that Kant talked about, the sense in which the waves are coming towards you. Or you might have a video of someone who's taken a collapse of snow that's crashing, tumbling down towards you, and then it hits the camera and it's over. There's something about nature that can simply overwhelm you. And these things can simply obliterate us, and we're gone. But for us, Stephen says, the thing that can save us, in fact, the only thing Stephen says that can save us, is the human imagination. We have to find a way that no matter what pressure is brought against us, we can find a way to fight against it. And that's what you keep finding in Stephen's. What music can I find within me to sustain me as a sandstorm takes over the White Chapel, if you will, or whatever it is that we live in?
Well, yeah. So what you've just said is the perfect introduction to another piece of tape we have here of Stevens reading his own work. So I just want to listen to it. This is Wallace Stevens reading Final Soliloquy of the Interior Paramour.
Here now we forget each other and ourselves. We feel the obscurity of an order, a whole, a knowledge, that which arranged the rendezvous within its vital boundary in the mind. We say, God and the imagination are one. How high That highest candle lights the dark.
That's an excerpt of Wallace Stevens reading his own work, Final Soliloquy of the Interior Paramour. You know, Paul, earlier you were talking about the sublime, and it occurred to me that another word some people use for the sublime is God. And then you also talked about Stevens and the human imagination. So how does religion figure into all of this?
Yeah, it's... that poem just... Okay, I'm sorry. You can... It's so incredible what Stevens is doing there. Here he is at the end of his life. He's in his 70s. He will die at 75. And he sees himself as an old man with a shawl around his shoulders, sitting alone in a room and thinking. And he realizes the thing that I've desired, what I'm looking for, this thing I call the sublime, how do I reach it? The only way I can reach it, really, as a human being, is through my imagination. Whereas he's reached out at the mountains, etc., you know, or the sea, now he's turned inward, and he finds within that God and the imagination finally are one. It's as though what he's been looking for all his life goes by the name, one name is God. And then notice what he says. He says, we say. In other words, there's always that modernist sense of, okay, I'm willing to commit to this. But there's this modernist sense of, you know, holding off just a little bit, you know. And yet what happens, even as he holds off, he's flying over towards that mystery. He wants to be absorbed by that mystery.
Mm-hmm. It's clearly a mystery that absorbs you as well.
Yes. Yeah.
May I just ask you, how old are you?
I'm 76.
Okay. Forgive me for being so nosy, near the very beginning of our conversation, you said that for 50 years you'd been reading and thinking about Stevens. And I just wonder now, how has what he means to you changed over time? Because I've heard you just react so powerfully to the little excerpts we played of Stevens reading his own verse.
The things he says, it's the human mind searching for something. Will it ever reach that? We would hope, but perhaps we won't. But it's the desire to move towards that sense of fulfillment or completion. I can't think of another poet, any poet, who touches me as deeply as Stevens does. It's as though he were in this room with me right now.
Well, Paul Mariani is a poet and an English professor at Boston College. He has written biographies of many of the great 20th century American poets. His latest is The Whole Harmonium, The Life of Wallace Stevens. What a joy it's been to speak with you, Paul. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Magna. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you as well.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.